The topic for today's Thought Leader Podcast is the future church. The podcast starts in an unlikely place, Luther's 1526 explanation to the German Mass. In the explanation, Luther demonstrates a helpful framework to resolve the tension that many experience between retreating into the past and pressing forward into the future. Today's podcast was authored by Dr. Todd Jones of the Michigan District.
Thank you for joining me for this podcast. In today's session, I want to spend time talking about the future church. To be clear, I'm not talking about the future of the invisible Christian church, you know, the one true holy Christian church. God makes that future abundantly clear in Matthew 24 and 25. I'm talking about the visible church, our congregations, our denomination. There is no shortage of doomsday prophets who proclaim that the end of the traditional or historic Christian church is near. I disagree with this Debbie Downer view, which, in my humble opinion, ignores the power of the gospel to break down all barriers and conquer all obstacles. The scriptures and human history offer many examples of God's kingdom flourishing in the heat and sorrow of persecution, of men and women who once despised the gospel, bowing their heads with tears of joy at the news that God's love was even for them. However, I also believe that it is foolish to assume that life in our congregations will be as it always has been, that we can continue doing church with the same cultural assumptions as if the world were not changing. The religious attitudes of people in our cultural context have changed. We're increasingly seeking comfort for our moral dilemmas in science or human reason. Our culture readily accepts the narrative that religion is merely a personal weakness and that Christian faith does not add anything to community. But it's not just non-believers who've changed. Most Christians in North America have experienced a shift in their desire for spirituality. The traditionalists most often cling to traditions and outer forms of faith expressions for a sense of security and control. Their desire for security and control are the motivators for driving the resurgence in high church liturgical movements and an acceptance that unity in practice equates purity with theology. Preoccupation with purity is not a new thing in times of uncertainty. This is a common response of people of faith. C.F.W. Walther recognized this as a past mistake that hindered the work of the immigrant church as it settled down in the U.S. 2 years before the founding of Synod, he wrote, "God knows that we ourselves under Stephan had nothing else in mind but to prove ourselves completely faithful to the true Lutheran Church. But there was nothing which caused us to fail in this very thing more than our stubborn exclusiveness." The traditionalists represent one side of the church's response to uncertainty. The progressives represent a second side of the response. The progressive seeks to stabilize and regain control by grasping for new methods and new experiences that incorporate the cultural changes that surround them. In the extreme, progressives too often tie their identity to their success. It becomes extremely important to validate one's identity by demonstrating numerical growth. The growth might be in the size of worship attendance. It might be in the number of individuals who follow them on social media or listen to their podcast. Obviously, present companies excluded. St. Paul wrote about the danger of compromise or centering one's identity in the value systems of the world in Romans 12:2. He said, "Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will." I mention these two approaches because I believe that there's an unhealthy tension in many of our congregations and ministries, which are the result of the struggle between the traditionalist and the progressives. One side seeks to drive the church into the safe harbor of uniformity and tradition and practice. The other side seeks to push the church into the inevitable future, at least as they see it. Yet there is a better way, a different response. I was struck with this thought recently as I prepared for a presentation on Luther's introduction to the German Mass. It's a fascinating read and a helpful look at Luther's response to uncertainty. Luther published his German Mass 9 years after nailing the 95 Theses to the door in Wittenberg. In the intervening years, the Protestant Church was being torn in two directions, the directions of the progressives and the traditionalists. Worship became the center of the tear, the dividing line. The heart of the Roman Catholic view of atonement was the Mass. In the Mass, the people offered a sacrifice to God in order to receive forgiveness. Thomas Aquinas, in his work Summa Theologia, explained, "From this, the Mass derives its name. The deacon on the festival days dismisses the people at the end of Mass, saying, 'Ite missa esta.' That is, the victim, Jesus, has been sent to God through the angel so that it may be accepted by God." The belief was that the celebration of communion by the priest was a sacrifice made to God by the priest. It was a work done by the priest on behalf of the people. The people would be dismissed with the statement, "Go, the sacrifice has been sent to God." The Mass, in Luther's day, was a way for an individual to buy forgiveness from God. When the Reformation occurred, one side of the Reformers, the traditionalists, wanted nothing to do with the worldliness of the Roman Mass. They wanted to return to the simple pattern of worship found in the New Testament. Calvin and others sought to destroy any hint of the veneration of saints or the corruption of the Catholic clergy or the selling of forgiveness. They viewed them as progressive, worldly. They believed that the church needed to return to its New Testament roots. On the other hand, you had those who did not want to unduly injure those who were weak in the faith by removing the icons of faith or the ceremonies with which they were familiar. They believed that it was best to redeem the outward forms by connecting them with an orthodox theology. The struggle between the two camps continued, one side trying to push the church into the future and the other side trying to pull the church back into the past. In 1526, Luther published his German Mass. The Mass looked a great deal like the Roman Mass. The music was distinctly German, and the words of the service, for the first time, were in the common language of the people. What I find important for this podcast is the introduction that Luther wrote to the Mass. It is as interesting for what it doesn't say as for what it does say. Luther does not wade into the fight over the church of the future. He does not attempt to define a path for the future. He does not talk about the importance of the past. He doesn't even talk about the theology of the Mass. He does give us a healthy framework for considering the church of the future. In his introduction to the German Mass, Luther describes three different kinds of services. The German word translated service is Ordnung. The word is usually translated as order or pattern. In selecting the word, Luther establishes that he's talking about the form of the Mass, not the theology of the Mass. The first order he described was the Latin Mass. Luther said, "The first, in Latin, which we published lately, called the Formula Missae, this I do not want to have set aside or changed, but as we have heretofore kept it, so should we be still free to use it where and when we please, or as occasion requires. I do not want in any wise to let the Latin tongue disappear out of the divine service, for I am so deeply concerned for the young." Now, what is Luther's concern for the young? Not that they become disconnected from the ancient church or unfamiliar with the traditions of the church. Luther explains his concern for the young as he continues, "If it lay in my power, and the Greek and the Hebrew tongues were as familiar to us as the Latin, and possessed as great a store of fine music and song as the Latin does, Mass should be held, and there should be singing and reading on alternate Sundays in all four languages, German, Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. I am by no means of one mind with those who set all their store by one language and despise all others, for I would gladly raise up a generation able to be of use to Christ in foreign lands and to talk with their people so that we might not be like the Waldenses of Bohemia, whose faith is so involved in the toils of their language that they can talk intelligibly and plainly with no one unless he first learned their language." His concern was that the young would not love the study of languages, and therefore not be available for Christ to call as missionaries. Notice that Luther's value of Latin Mass was as a language tool to prepare children to be missionaries, to do what he established earlier in his introduction, that they might give an answer for their faith and be able to, in time, teach others and aid in the advancement of the kingdom of Christ. Luther ends the discussion about the Latin Mass with this rhetorical question: "Who knows how God will make use of them, the young, in years to come?" The primary value that Luther saw in the Latin Mass, the Mass of the traditional church, was that it could be used to prepare the youth of the present church for the changes that might come to the future church. In other words, For Luther, a value of the Mass, in addition to receiving God's grace through the means of grace, was missionary formation of the young. It helped them to become competent in languages and thereby be more valuable as future missionaries. The second service, or Ordnung, was the German Mass. Luther wrote, "Next, there is the German Mass and divine service of which we are now treating. This ought to be set up for the sake of the simple layman. Both these kinds of service, then, we must have held and publicly celebrated in the church for the people in general. They are not yet believers or Christians." Notice that Luther wrote the German Mass for the simple and the non-believer. By crafting the Mass in the German language, he made it easier for the simple-minded person to understand the theology and enable the service to be evangelistic outreach to the non-believers. Luther spoke of the German Mass as a type of attractional evangelism. He wrote, "Both these kinds of services, then, we must have held and publicly celebrated in church for the people in general. They are not yet believers or Christians, but the greater part stand there and gape simply to see something new, and it is just as if we held divine service in an open square or a field amongst the Turks or heathens." Luther cast an image of the heathen standing in the square, listening to the service and gaping at the liturgy and the music and the drama. Perhaps in that moment he will hear the gospel and believe. Luther called the German Mass a public allurement to faith and Christianity. Before we talk about the third service, I want to pause a couple of minutes and consider how Luther handled the question about the future church. Up to this point, he has not described a future church that is a discontinuation of the present church. In other words, he recognized that the present church and its structures provided a natural opportunity to prepare God's people for the future church. He argued, "Why drop the Latin? It can prepare the youth of the church for future mission opportunities." He argued, "Why not build bridges with the world by creating a mass which is for the German people in the language of the German people?" He didn't attempt to describe the church of the future. He attempted to demonstrate how the church of today can equip people for the future church. Notice, too, that the choice of the mass, Latin or German, did not have to do with the past. Luther doesn't extol the virtues of being historically connected to the early church as a reason for Latin or German. Luther was focused on the future, but connected to the present. Having said that, the third service presents a very different side of Luther. It presents the future-focused Luther. Listen to how he describes this third service. "But the third sort of divine service, which the true type of evangelical order should embrace, must not be celebrated so publicly in the square amongst all and sundry." Notice that this service is not a public service. It's not an evangelistic service. Yet it is what Luther calls a true type of evangelical order. This is the pattern, the Ordnung, that Luther desired to see form among those who were truly Christian. That is, the practicing Christians, he writes. "Those, however, who are desirous of being Christians in earnest, and who are ready to profess the gospel with hand and mouth, should register their names and assemble by themselves in some house to pray, to read, to baptize, and to receive the sacraments, and practice other Christian works." Notice that this service is for those who are desirous of being Christians in earnest. Luther avoids using the term mature, such as those who strive to live as mature Christians. The concept of maturation or immaturity amongst Christians denies the ongoing process of sanctification. Until we achieve perfection in our new life with Christ, we're always immature. That is, we're in the process of being matured. We have not achieved full maturity yet. However, there are those who have been baptized into the faith and, when convenient, hold on to the name of Christ. And then there are those who desire to live the Christian faith in all earnestness. Luther is signaling out this third service is for that latter group, those who desire to live out the Christian faith in all earnestness. As will be more clearly articulated in a couple of lines, it is accountability that distinguishes one group from the other. Those who desire to live the Christian faith will practice a high level of accountability. Luther did not envision this third service as taking place in the church, but in the Christian home. He did not envision the priest being involved. The essential elements of the Mass would be present: the word, the sacraments, and Christian works of mercy and stewardship. For most of us, the thought of communion occurring in the home without the pastor or priest would seem heretical. In fact, in a Lutheran church, it is strongly discouraged. Luther did not see a difficulty with the practice if it rose organically from the midst of those who sought to live out the Christian faith in earnestness. It did not replace public worship. This third service was not a replacement for the Latin and the German service. It was just a different kind of service, a third kind of service. Luther continued, "In this order, those whose conduct was not such as befits Christians could be recognized, reproved, reformed, rejected, or excommunicated according to the rule of Christ in Matthew 18. Notice the level of accountability that was to take place in this third service. This wasn't going to be a watered-down church service. This wasn't going to be a watered-down congregation. It was a congregation focused on reforming personal life through the word, through the sacrament, and through accountability. People would be so transparent that accountability could happen in a healthy fashion. People would be so transparent that accountability could take place in a healthy manner. People would not be offended when asked to account for their actions. Luther envisioned this as an iron sharpening iron scenario." He continues, "Here too, a general giving of alms could be imposed on Christians to be willingly given and divided among the poor after the example of St. Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 9. While the group would meet in homes and practice accountability, it would be public in service." Luther continues, "Here there would not be need of much fine singing. Here we could have baptism and the sacrament in short and simple fashion, and direct everything toward the word and prayer and love. Here we should have a good short catechism about the Creed, the Ten Commandments, and the Lord's Prayer." Notice that the service would not be elaborate. It's surprising that Luther says the service would not have much singing, given that he loved singing and he wrote many hymns. However, public singing for Luther was about witnessing to the world and to those who are still not actively practicing their faith. The word and sacraments are the meat and potatoes of the Christian who is active in his or her faith. It's very much like courtship and marriage. In courtship, we seek to win the love of another with public, sometimes lavish displays of affection. When we were young, we thought that making a fool of ourselves to prove our love for another was what love was all about. However, as we matured in marriage, we realized that love is not expressed in nice words, beautiful music, or crazy demonstrations of affection. And those might still be valued, but what is truly treasured is the deep intimacy that comes from our love's abiding presence in our worst times, our most troubled times, those times that we cannot even love ourselves. That kind of love is not expressed in flash and pop. It is a lasting, warm embrace and a gentle conversation and a word of encouragement. This third service is about shifting our love from the flashbang of courtship to the abiding love of marriage. It is the deep study of the word. It is the prayer. It is accountability. It is service. Now, Luther did not start this third service. He did not organize a strategy to form this third kind of service. He merely shared his belief in the value of the importance of it. He explained why he did not form this new service. In one word, if we only had people who longed to be Christians in earnest, form and order would soon shape itself. Luther asserted that this third service would organically arise from the midst of Christians who long to be Christians in earnest. Here's where his genius really shines. There have been many modern-day attempts to establish a third kind of service. In the early 1990s, there was a movement called the Metachurch Movement. It had close ties to the Charismatic Church Movement, and it taught that the church was like a two-winged bird. It had large gathering, celebration, and a small house gathering, a cell, and that the cell and the celebration worked together collaboratively. And yet in North America, the cell church movement, the house church movement, collapsed in a variety of errors. More recently, there has been an effort to revive this cell church movement with a concept called the missional community. Missional communities are groups of believers who gather to encourage each other and serve their neighbors. Many churches have attempted, often with little success, to replicate the success of the missional communities in Europe. I believe that Luther had it right. This third service grows out of healthy first and second services. When we attempt to force a change or to create the third service without sufficient grounding in God's Word, which produces dependence on God's means of grace, we allow unchecked sin to pollute the intimate relationships of the third service. Luther writes, "In the meantime, I would abide by the two orders aforesaid, and publicly among the people aid in the promotion of such divine service, besides preaching, as shall exercise the youth and call and incite others to faith, until those Christians who are most thoroughly in earnest shall discover each other and cleave together, to the end that there be no faction forming such as might ensue if we were to settle everything out of my own head. If we want to see the church strengthen and God's kingdom grow, I believe that we have to focus on a clear goal for our services and align what we do and how we do with that goal. As Luther said long ago, but above all, the order is for the simple and for the young folk who must daily be exercised in the Scripture and God's Word." Now listen to the reason. "To the end that they may become conversant with Scripture and expert in its use, ready and skillful in giving an answer for their faith, and able in time to teach others and aid in the advancement of the kingdom of Christ." Around us, there is a level of conflict about worship and the nature of the church. It is experienced by the common person sitting in the pew in the conflict between contemporary and traditional. It is experienced in the questions about the death of the traditional church. It is felt by theologians and pastors as they consider the nature of the church in the 21st century. There is a tension of striving forward for change while retreating backward into stability. Luther's introduction gives us some comfort and guidance amidst the striving. The path forward is defined by the purpose for worship. It will look a lot like what church has looked like for centuries because it's formed by our theology. It will look a lot like our communities because worship is a witness to our children and our neighbors. It will look a lot like what God leads His people to do as they seek to live out their faith in all earnestness. No matter what it looks like, God's gifts are present when His word is proclaimed and His gifts are given in the sacraments. Now, at the beginning of this podcast, I mentioned that I believe there was a better approach to the tension created by the traditionalists and progressives. And I believe that Martin Luther, in his introduction to the German Mass, describes that better response to the uncertainty of our times. First, Luther did not radically change the Latin Mass, but neither did he chain the hope for the future to the Latin liturgy. Rather, he treasured the contribution the Latin Mass could make to the future church. He was able to hold the past, present, and future church in tension because he was focused on the purpose of the Mass, equipping future generations to be available for God's mission call. Second, Luther did not throw out the church that was present in the hope of creating a future church. The mission challenge that was before Luther was the least and the lost in Germany. The German Mass connected with that culture. It accomplished the work of God among the people who were present outside the church doors. Finally, confident that he was preparing God's people to be missionaries to the future generations and that he was a living example of loving the neighbor God had placed in front of him, Luther was free to speculate about the future church, the third service, while being confident enough to trust God to unfold that service in his time. I want to encourage you to get a copy of Luther's Introduction to the German Mass and read through it for yourself. Ponder how Luther's introduction and challenge to focus the worship service on the young, the new believer, and the non-believer might impact your worship planning and other ministries of the church. How can we maximize the time we have to equip our members to be defenders of the faith and ambassadors of the gospel? An English translation of Luther's Introduction to the German Mass can be found through an online search. However, I'd be glad to send you a copy for further study. If you have Luther's works, it can be found in Volume 53, the Liturgy and Hymns section of that volume. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me at todd.jones@michigandistrict.org. Have a great day in the Lord.